Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The matter before us today is the case of Stack versus Green. And Council, I want to advise you that you will each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument, and feel free to set the podium at the desired height that matches that you want it to be. And are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right, you may do so.
May it please the court, I am Rhea Bornman Spears of Bornman Family Law. I am here on behalf of Appellant Lamont Green. My office specializes in parental alienation and grandparent alienation, which I note because of the nature of this case, and because this case did not have the benefit of the court's August 2018 decision that has allowed us to argue parental alienation as a basis of endangerment since. So I note that. It seems it's probably prudent that I first address the timeliness of my brief, as counsel pointed out in his brief. And I know that there are four factors to consider: whether or not he was prejudiced, whether my lateness was justifiable, whether all briefs were subsequently filed, which they were, and whether our underlying appeal has merit, which of course I hope that the court believes it does. The argument that counsel was prejudiced, I of course would disagree with that based on the fact that I filed it at 12:53 in the morning, so it was 53 minutes later. I assume that counsel was sleeping during that entire time, of course, and I did hit submit at that time to when I salvaged what I had left after a technology error. And obviously I believe that it's consequence enough for my reputation that I submitted a late brief. That's a less than perfect document because of what I had to put back together after a technology issue. And that should not be my client's consequence. Of course, that should fall entirely on my responsibility. And then to get into the argument, abuse of discretion is the standard. We all know that for family law cases. And I am arguing that the district court abused their discretion because they made speculations about my client that are the make or break of this case.
Are you arguing issues of law, or are you arguing that some of the facts were clearly erroneous?
Both, Your Honor. I am arguing that she left out facts that were crucial and contradicted the notion that she clearly went into her writing of her order with, and that she misapplied the law. That's another argument as well, if I've answered your question.
All right. Well, why don't we take, if we could split that up. And I'm very literal. So
okay.
If you can point to facts in the record that you believe are clearly erroneous, or specific facts that you think are not supported by the record.
I will, Your Honor. I'm going to start with the argument that my client either abused the child or let him be abused in his care. I would say...
Well, I'm not sure that that's consistent with the district court's finding, though. In fact, the district court made it very clear that it was not certain as to whether or not father actually abused the child. So that is part of the district court's finding.
Yes.
What the district court did say, and I'm paraphrasing, but I believe the district court said something to the fact that the child was harmed while staying at father's residence.
And the court...
Those are two very distinct things.
Yes.
So there's no finding that father abused the child.
You are exactly right. It's an implied that he's responsible because it happened in his care. And that, I believe, is how she applies it back to the statute, by saying that he was neglectful, or the first prong of the statute, 257C.03, where it says that the parent has abandoned, neglected, or otherwise exhibited disregard for the child's well-being to the extent that the child will be harmed while living with the parent. I believe that she's relying on her implying that it happened during father's care, And the court is careful to say two different times in the order that she cannot say for certain that father harmed the child, but she is speculating that the harm happened in father's care and by someone father knew.
Why is that a speculation?
Because there is evidence in the record, for example, the fact that the child reported to Corner House that he was injured by his sister, the one that lived in his grandparents' house. The court completely left out that fact. The child reports being injured by that other child several times, and that is a crucial component. There's also the arguments that the child on April 12th is the day that the Stacks filed the order for protection against father. It's also a day that the child was with a babysitter who testified and provided a picture, which is Exhibit 106, of the child on the same day that the child was allegedly hit in the head with a frying pan by dad. And then the testimony outlines the timeline to where father would have had to hit the child in the head with a frying pan in the car ride. And, of course, the court also
But isn't that the district court didn't give credit to that, though, because, as we both agreed, the district court did not find that father abused the child.
The district court found that there were bruises to the child, including to his head, and that they happened during father's time. But the problem is the district court did not have evidence to back that up.
What about all the testimony from the various people that, not in addition to Corner House, because I believe the district court did give greater credence to the testimony from other individuals versus what was stated by Corner House.
And frankly, I would say that the court should have given the same weight to what was said in Corner House.
But see, that's the thing, is the district court is in the best place to make credibility determinations, and we don't review credibility determinations at this level.
I understand that. But what I mean is she left out those facts. She left out that information that the child, for example, had accused the sister, that the child had been inconsistent in his report. She didn't leave out that he had made inconsistent statements, but the fact that he'd been inconsistent in who he accused, that was something that's really relevant as well.
Does that really matter, though? Because on review, we're supposed to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the district court's ruling and the credibility determinations. So if the district court doesn't mention other statements, we're to assume that the district court didn't credit those statements.
The reason that it matters is because the court had evidence before it that the child could have been hurt in the care of the Stacks.
And right, but we have to assume that the district court discredited that evidence then.
And the district court ignored evidence that contradicted the theory, and that would be the theory that the injuries happened at father's house. But the point is that the court has to, the abuse of discretion standard is that the court has to have facts and findings. It has to, there has to be evidence to support these allegations. The criminal.
What evidence is it that you're asserting the district court ignored?
The fact that the criminal investigation did not determine that the injuries happened in Mr. Green's care, the fact that the child protection investigation did not determine that these injuries happened in Mr. Green's care, and both of those individuals did a much more thorough investigation on the ground than the court's level from the bench of hearing different testimony. And again, there was also the information about that individual who was with the child, who did testify about not seeing any marks on the child. There's also the fact that allegations of abuse went back to the time frame during which Mr. Nesser was investigating and the custody evaluator, and they didn't come up during his on-the-ground investigation either, which is also very important because he recommended that the sole physical and legal custody be given to father. And I took...
But that was earlier, though.
Yes, and I'm going to get to that. He took great pains... Go ahead.
And can I ask you this? Because, I mean, you're making arguments. I assume you made these same arguments before the district court or someone made these arguments.
I was not the prior attorney, and I don't believe that these arguments were made to the same extent because the parental alienation argument was not thoroughly made. It was implied based on...
But it was heavily contested in the trial.
Yes.
As to whether, you know, whether this occurred during his supervision of the child, correct?
I would say that the record supports that. Yes, Your
Honor. Okay. Now, here's the problem, that you have, and I don't know how we as a reviewing court get around this, but I'm looking at the... I'm looking at the order. It's the finding of fact and order denying amended findings in a new trial. All right. And it's on the A35. And it's with regard to finding 49, 40 in parentheses 9. And it says, overall, the court found father's denial of harm to the child while in his care as not credible. So the court made a credibility determination as to the father's denial. I mean, don't we have to defer to that credibility determination?
I believe that there is a lot of documentation in case law in our two briefs about the credibility of witnesses. And I do think that the totality of the evidence supports the court having found my client credible. But of course, I'm left with a record where they didn't. But there is additional information from other witnesses that the court did not say that they didn't find credible that was not included that would support my arguments that the child was not abused during dad's time.
But and there is testimony from that the district court did credit from the petitioners, from the corner house interview, from Linton, and from Bergman. So the district court did explicitly credit that testimony. And as Judge Hooten said, we really can't do much in terms of on appeal in terms of those credibility determinations. We didn't hear that testimony. We leave that to the district court to make those determinations.
Well, Your Honor, part of my argument is that what is written in the statute was not proven in the findings that there are. So if we leave the credibility as it is, I also spent a lot of time critiquing that in my brief and talking about the fact that there is not findings that support that he abandoned the child. There are not findings to support that he has neglected the child. And this is a difficult case. I am in a difficult position.
Well, and you only have like 2.5 minutes now. So let's talk about something we can review de novo, which is the judge's application of the law.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that's where I do believe that the judge has failed my client. And I do believe that the alternative theory, of course, should have been discussed that this is a grandparent alienation case and that the court does document the concerns about the fact that the therapist is discussing the case in front of the child. There is a lot in this record about the child having heard the grandparents report that the child was abused, including at the doctor's office, where the grandfather tells the doctor in front of the child that he was hit in the head with a frying pan by dad. And so there is a lot of evidence in this record and a lot of reason to look at, as I keep mentioning, the alternative theory that this is a parental alienation case. And the reason that I spent so much time in my facts section going through the components of the transcript that were left out is to show a pattern that Mr. Nesser came out with the custody evaluation in February saying that my client should have full custody. He was investigating, as I mentioned, a time period that included allegations of abuse. They went retroactive to that time frame, and he didn't have any concerns. Then Immediately thereafter, the grandparents ramp up efforts and start making allegations. It's the same month that custody evaluation came out, the therapist notes that the child has all loving caregivers and the child is benefiting from all of his caregivers providing loving care to him. Then suddenly, the next month, we have allegations. And then the child is suddenly afraid. And now, even a year later, after no contact with dad, is still supposedly so afraid, when instead we should know that if the threat is removed, the child would recover and be less afraid, not in a fetal position, not the things that are described, unless his caretakers are continuing to feed that fear. And I
so what is the district court's misapplication of the law?
The district court's misapplication of the law is finding that my client has the statute 257C.03, finding that my client has done any of those factors, because we disagree with that thoroughly, that would lead to him losing his fundamental right to parent and letting this third party custodian action move forward beyond that point.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Brandon Zumwalt, attorney for the respondents Patrick and Colleen Stack, who are here and present today. The main issue here on appeal, after hearing the appellant's argument, is whether the proper application of 257C.03 subdivision 7 was made here. There's also some allusion to fundamental rights of parenting. However, I think the main issue here would be whether the district court applied those factors under 257C.03 subdivision 7.
Are you going to address your motion to dismiss?
Your Honor, I can certainly address the motion to dismiss. I will rest more heavily on the outline of the brief. However, I will say there were certainly issues with the timing of the brief as I received it. I did not receive paper versions of it until well after the Labor Day weekend, which cut into our ability to respond. I think more importantly, too, is The rules regarding brief formatting, brief binding, they had gone by the wayside. I received loose paper in an envelope when I got it on September 6th.
Okay. Are you claiming prejudice?
Your Honor, I will claim prejudice just from the timeline of it. My clients, we were very timely when we served ours. We provided enough time for any reply brief, though one was not done. We were due to get that brief by the end of August. We did not get it until the first full week of September. Our brief timing started.
You got the electronic version, though.
We did correct. Get an electronic version, correct.
53 minutes late, correct? Is that correct?
It did come the next day. I believe that it was filed in the early morning, correct.
All right. Thank you.
You were able to print that out?
Yes, we were able to print that out the following day. The prejudice from my client's perspective would be, and it's minimal, I will concede, the cost of printing versus getting a finished copy and being able to disseminate that. But I will rest on the further outline in the brief. I'd like to really specifically focus on the application that's been raised by the appellant. And specifically, this is an abuse of discretion, standard of review. The findings of the trial court are to be examined in the light most favorable to those. And I think of key importance here is deference to the trial court on credibility of witnesses. The court has already keyed in on that. The record supports the district court's lengthy order. We had 3 days of trial. We had 12 witnesses. We had 37 exhibits. Referee Moses heard everything, took it in, issued the order. As a brief bit of background, the respondents in this appeal received custody of the child when he was 2 years old, though he had lived with them for his entire life predominantly. That is subject to some argument, but the district court did find that they were involved in his life from the very beginning. The respondents have been the safety net for the child, GLS. His mother had chemical dependency issues and was in the house and out of the house on regular occasions with and without the children. The father of GLS and the father of his sister were not present at the beginning of their lives, or really for GLS, this case, until this case started. At the time of trial, it had been 1 year since the child had had any contact with the appellant, and it is throughout the record shown that the child still had fear of appellant. That is not fear testified to only by the respondents. That is fear testified to by the child's play therapist. That is fear testified to by the guardian ad litem. And that is fear testified to by the appellant's own choice for a reunification therapist. I mean, that is the reunification therapist he chose for the reunification therapy. And his witness testified at trial that the child curled up in the fetal position and was afraid of father. The district court determined that this fear stemmed from physical and emotional danger in appellant's home. The timing for this fear was narrowed down by the play therapist to be between February 2016 and April of 2016. April 2016 marked the time when the respondents went and received an ex parte order for protection, which ceased communication with appellant. So that is why that is the bookend for that time of fear and harm. The fear and harm experienced by the child was so great that the play therapist actually had to change his diagnosis. The play therapist changes his diagnosis from an adjustment disorder to post-traumatic stress disorder and had to take therapy in an entirely different direction because of the fear that he exhibited. Several witnesses testified at the trial about the physical harm that they saw on the child after time with appellant. Again, that is not just the respondents testifying. While the respondent, Patrick Stack, did testify to what he saw, the daycare provider testified that she saw bruising. She saw fork tine marks. The medical records submitted to the court outlined that the physician assistant saw bruising on the temples consistent with being hit in the head. That was after appellant's time.
What about the arguments, though, that the appellant brings this morning that that there was evidence that he was also injured while in the care of the Stacks?
In the court order, the district court's order outlines that and states that there were times, and we absolutely concede that there were times where this 2- and 4-year-old, he was injured in the Stacks' home as well. He was hit in the eye with Play-Doh from his sister. He was hospitalized due to ingestion of cough medicine. The district court took that testimony, acknowledged that testimony, and came to the conclusion that these were accidents. It wasn't intentional. Children do routinely get hurt through clumsiness, but what the district court keyed in on those credibility determinations was that the injuries sustained to his head, to his chest, to his knees, those were not accidents. Someone inflicted those injuries on a 4-year-old child, on a 3-year-old child at the time.
So why isn't those inferences pure speculation? Because the district court did not state who inflicted those.
That's absolutely correct. And I think that is an important point for me to distinguish from the appellant's position. The district court did not come out and say that it was father who caused this. And that is an important distinction. The appellant wants to rest and say there was no maltreatment finding, there was no criminal finding. But that absolutely disregards the district court's specific finding that the child was hurt in his home, not necessarily by him, but hurt in his home. And the district court further found that the child experienced harm in his home through these injuries.
But why the difference that in the Stacks home they're considered accidents, but in father's home they're not considered accidents? I mean, as you highlighted, as any parent knows, children get injured all the time. They run into things, they fall down, they injure themselves, and with siblings, siblings sometimes take liberties in terms of using their other sibling as a punching bag or who knows what else. We've seen that. We've all seen that happen. So why is one an accident, one is not?
Well, I think the repetitive nature of the incidences are one. The district court found that GLS was hurt in appellant's home on more than one occasion. He had repeated marks from forks, repeated bruising over repetitive actions. Where being hit in the eye with a can of Play-Doh, that was a one-time incident. The ingestion of cough syrup, one-time incidents, the respondents absolutely made sure that that did not happen again. But repeatedly coming home with bruises and marks and bite marks and reporting, I think that is really an important part here too, is the fact of what the child was reporting. The child reported to the physician assistant for medical care saying that he was hit in the head by his father with a frying pan because he took a French fry. That story changed, but what was consistent is he kept reporting that he was hit in the head and it happened at father's house. And so the important distinction between what happened at the respondent's home versus what happened at the appellant's home, one, the respondents took measures to make sure that it never happened again. But two, it repeatedly happened at appellant's home and they were intentional acts. And the child was reporting that his father was involved. And I think that is the very important distinction between an accident and suffering harm. And that is ultimately what the district court determined in regards to the 257C.03 statute, is that it's not abandonment, it's not neglect. The district court found that placement of the child with an individual other than the parent took priority because the child was going to be emotionally and physically endangered in appellant's home.
So are you saying that under the statute 257C.03 subdivision 7, are you saying that the district court applied subdivision 2 rather than subdivision 1?
I think the district court applied 1 and 2 because there's findings in the court order that the child suffered harm in father's home, which 1 outlines. 1 does outline harm, and then 2 outlines future physical and emotional danger.
Where can you point to where the district court's analysis applies both subdivision 1 and subdivision 2? That's a question I have.
Absolutely.
Because the appellant argues that it was under subdivision 1, but it seems like you're arguing subdivision 2 as well.
I think it's absolutely clear that it's subdivision 2. The specific findings in the court order are that the priority of placement requires the child to be placed with a third party because of the threat of emotional and physical danger, which is exactly what subdivision 2 outlines. That's repeated throughout the court order.
Right, but the way the statute is structured, it's in the disjunctive.
Correct.
So you don't necessarily have to satisfy subdivision 1 to meet the requirements of subdivision 2. They can stand alone.
Absolutely. And I believe that they are disjunctive. 1 or 2 are enough to carry the burden. But in my reading of the district court's decision, 1 and 2 apply.
So it's your position that the district court apply that even though there's no explicit finding or conclusion of law stating that then?
Yes. Yes,
it is. And do you have specific findings that you think support subdivision 2?
Yes, in the court order, I believe that these specific findings that support subdivision 2 come at the end of the 257C.03 analysis, right before the district court analyzes that the response, or that at the district court level, the petitioners, the stacks, are interested third parties. It concludes that the placement of the child with the individual takes priority over preserving the day-to-day parent-child relationship because of the presence of physical or emotional danger to the child. That is in the order under the court's specific analysis. And I think that is the strongest reasoning for the court to make the decision that it did. While I also believe that 1 would still apply, because the court does make a finding that the child goes to the extent of saying the child was clearly harmed while in father's care, which would be enough, in my opinion, to trigger subdivision one, stating that the child will be harmed by living with the parent. There's a historical harm. I think that it can certainly be argued that there would be a continuing harm given the facts that were alleged.
But given the fact that we don't even know who caused the harm, and arguably it could be considered speculation, the district court did note that it was actually moved by the fact that the child would not be able to see father or see father's family. So is that finding clearly erroneous by the district court then?
No, I don't believe that that finding's clearly erroneous, and I believe that the district court was appropriate in stating that it was moved by the fact that the district court judge understood the ramifications of the decision that were being made. But that's also why the district court judge took the position of outlining a way for the appellant to reintegrate himself into the child's life. This was not a decision that granted permanent custody to Patrick and Colleen Stack and then closed the case. This was a decision that said we are granting permanent custody to Patrick and Colleen Stack. However, we have laid out, in essence, a case plan for father to follow so that when he is done working these, so we can make sure that therapeutic intervention has been made and the child will be safe, then he can bring a request for parenting time assistance. So it allows for that plan for him to get back onto a level of having unsupervised parenting time. I do see that my time is done. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
I'll start off with saying that the court hit on exactly a point that I attempted to make in my brief, which is that they're considered accidents in the care of the Stacks and harm in the care of father. And that would be why I am also arguing that the court is speculating, because one could have even made an argument about whether or not the child was harmed based on the standard that the judge is using. If bruises and Play-Doh thrown at the eye and cough syrup involving hospitalization where the child's stomach swelled up to the size of a basketball, if that's not considered harm in the care of the Stacks, then why are bruising by the temples and a fork poke that can't be identified as far as the source not just considered accidents and are considered so great as to end this father's relationship with the child? And that's something counsel just brought up, that the court did a favor to father. That's implied in what he said about the plan for father's parenting time being reserved and the plan for how he can resume parenting time. But as we all know, in a parental alienation or a grandparental alienation case, that's a death sentence to the father's relationship with the child. There is not much else I can say based on staying within what's before the court for the record, but...
Well, but counsel, I think the district court did acknowledge that there certainly was hostility from the Stacks to father. Even given this order, that there needs to be effort by the Stacks to make sure that they play a role in getting father integrated into the life of the child, right?
That is correct. Unfortunately, with our court system, we often have the situation where courts treat parties like adults. You know, we would think that that's a good thing. They tell them, just get along. You're both high conflict. It's both of your fault. But unfortunately, that's not how it works in parental alienation cases. There is actually a party that likely has a mental health disorder that is causing them to be unable to act reasonable and is causing them to interfere with their relationship that's crucial to the child. Counsel brought up the fact that the child's diagnosis was turned into PTSD. Well, PTSD is a result of losing parents. This child has now lost both of the parents, of course, except we know that according to the transcript, that right before testimony, mother was allowed to have access to the children again, which of course would be, we'd argue, why she would suddenly change her testimony from saying that her father was a drunk and an abuser to suddenly saying that she lied then rather than lying now. But There's also evidence that the child wasn't primary, the Stacks were not the child's primary caregiver based on the fact that the June 2015 therapist notes indicate him crying for several sessions in a row while he transitioned from losing his mother as his primary caretaker and taking on the Stacks as his new primary caretaker. So that evidence was also left out by the court, but is documented in the transcript.
Right, but that's more of a legal determination rather than something that's based on the particular evidence that you cited.
That's right, Your Honor. That's simply relevant for the fact that counsel brought up that this child has PTSD and wants to say that that's further proof that father harmed the child, but there's further information and digging that should have gone into that before such an assertion can be made. It's not further proof of father having harmed the child, as counsel implied.
You know, you made a number of really compelling arguments today, but aren't you, in effect, though, asking us to reweigh this evidence and come up with a different result, which we, as you know, we can't do?
I think that, to answer Your Honor's question, my desire to have wished to have been the trial attorney who could have maybe sent this a different direction is probably interfering with my ability to separate the two. But I am arguing that the statute lays out, and as Your Honor pointed out, the two different prongs and whether or not the court misapplied the law. I do believe that the court misapplied the law and that that is where the abuse of discretion lies, and that there was not enough to make this finding that father should have essentially lose the custody that he was about to receive, according to Mr. Nesser's report, until all of these allegations suddenly came forward. I think I have anything further? Thank you.
All right. Thank you. The case has been very well briefed and argued. We will take the matter under advisement, and I will note that there are shortened timelines for these type of cases, and we will abide by those. Thank you.